length, and we've talked about the subtleties of the rise in the null case and all of that stuff. Now what I want to do is to move forward along those lines and talk about how to integrate on hypersurfaces. And again, there's going to be some subtleties that arise in the null case that are interesting and the usual kind of thing. So, well, we know how to integrate over space-time. We have, we have a metric, we know how to calculate its determinant, and we know that an invariant volume element in a four-dimensional space-time is going to be what you get when you, you combine the square root of the determinant with the coordinate. So an invariant volume element in space-time is this quantity right here, which can be shown to be invariant under coordinate transformations. So if you change coordinates, this by itself will not be invariant because it will be modified by the Jacobian of the coordinate transformation, and the square root of the metric determinant precisely makes up for that, and you find that the combination is something that's invariant. So for integration over four-dimensional regions, we know what to do. And one thing that I would like to point out now, because it'll it'll be relevant a little bit later, is the fact that when you're integrating over some piece of the manifold, some region M of the manifold, using this volume element, the only type of object that you're allowed to integrate is a scalar function. Because only scalars can be added at different points to make up, to make up a real tensorial operation. It would not be defined, it would not do to try to integrate a vector in a four-dimensional region of space-time, because that would amount to adding a bunch of vectors at different points, and this cannot be done unless you specify a rule to do that, and that's beyond what you would normally mean for straightforward integration. So the types of objects that can be integrated in space-time are scalar objects. And I'll come back to that point a little bit later when we talk about integrating over surfaces. Okay, so let me cover the time-like the time-like space-like case first. And we're going to do like we did this morning. So I'm going to talk about the time-like space-like case over here, and then we'll do the null case on a separate board. So so we're given a hypersurface, and the idea here would be to say, well, there's going to be some objects living on that hypersurface. There will be scalar functions of the coordinates YA that we've introduced on the hypersurface, and those scalar functions presumably can be integrated just as well as scalar functions in four-dimensional space-time can be integrated. And here, if we refer to everything living on the hypersurface, well, we have an induced metric on the hypersurface, we can calculate its determinant, and there's going to be an invariant, well, three-dimensional volume element associated with that. So all of those, notions, are just straightforwardly inherited from the four-dimensional statement. So so we have an induced metric, and because we have an induced metric, we have an element of three-dimensional volume, and because I want to stop saying three-dimensional volume, I'll call that a surface element, even though it's three-dimensional surface we're talking about here, not a two-dimensional surface. So we have a notion of an element of three-dimensional surface element, which is going to be obtained by taking the square root of the, absolute value of the metric determinant, because here it could be either negative or positive, depending on the signature of the surface. So we just take the absolute value of the determinant of that induced metric, multiply that by the coordinate volume element, and that gives us a really, well-defined notion of surface element on a hypersurface. In elementary three-dimensional vector calculus, we're sort of accustomed to promoting this into a vectorial volume element by multiplying this by the normal vector. And we can do the same thing here. This is a scalar volume element, but we can also define a vectorial volume element by combining this with the normal vector, and here we have the usual type of object that's, you know, that's defined as a vector, that's, you know, the length of that vector is proportional to this, but the vector itself is pointing outward, you know, in the normal direction. So this is the, you know, the straightforward, you know, surface element, but I can define also a directed surface element by just adjoining this with the normal vector. So it would be something, I can put the index down or up, it doesn't matter. I could just combine those two things and I have something that sticks out somewhere. So none of that is very surprising, and I think all of that is very straightforward. However, if you think of trying to adapt this construction to the null case, well, we're going to fail. And we're going to fail for two reasons. In the null case, the induced metric is two-dimensional. This guy is a three-dimensional object with a zero entry, so one of the eigenvalues of that matrix is actually zero, which means that the determinant defined properly as a 3x3 matrix determinant is actually zero for the null case. So that doesn't work. So this notion doesn't generalize. And the other thing that doesn't generalize is the fact that, well, even though we have a normal vector in the null case, it's not normalizable. And therefore, this quantity right here is sort of ambiguous, not, you know, terribly well defined. But presumably, the notion of surface element, even on a null surface, ought to be well defined. So even though this all works for the time-like case or the space-like case, it doesn't give us a way of generalizing that, or, you know, or thinking about what the proper replacements should be in the null case. Turns out that there's a better way of getting started in this discussion, which will in fact apply to all situations. So there's a notion of directed surface element that generalizes this construction right here and survives in the limit where the surface becomes null. So I'm going to consider that. I'm going to start from here and show that it reproduces those notions over here, but that in fact it's something that can be generalized from there to the null case. So let me introduce another notion of directed surface element that's not going to look like this, but in fact will reproduce that in the appropriate situation where the surface is either time-like or space-like. So another take on the surface element is the following quantity. I'm going to define a vectorial surface element like this, and I have to look up my notes because if I don't, I might mess it up. So I'll use mu as a free index. It's going to involve the Levi-Civita tensor that we defined a while back, and it's the Levi-Civita tensor contracted with three of our basis vectors on the hypersurface. And we multiply that by d3y. More concretely, this is the Levi-Civita tensor multiplying all the partial derivative of x alpha with respect to y1, dx beta with respect to y2, and dx gamma with respect to y3. And more concretely still, I'll just remind you that the Levi-Civita tensor is what you get when you take the space-time, the determinant of the space-time metric, and you combine it with the fully antisymmetric symbol, which has the usual property that, you know, it's going to be 0 or 1 or, you know, or minus 1, depending on the ordering of the indices here. So, well, it doesn't quite look obvious nor natural unless you are familiar with forms. And if you're familiar with forms, you'll recognize this object as the volume 4 form for four-dimensional space-time. And what we've done is to contract the 4 form with basis vectors on the hypersurface. So essentially, this whole construction here is the pullback of the volume 4 form down to the hypersurface. And, you know, if you think along those lines, and if that means anything to you, perhaps that, you know, starts to look like a plausible notion of three-dimensional volume on a hypersurface. But I'm not assuming that you know what that all means. And what I want to do is to sort of verify, first of all, that in the time-like case and space-like case, that this expression right here, in fact, gives us back what we got over here. Well, it's a rather formidable object, but it's really not that difficult to deal with. I mean, this, you know, has a lot of indices, but, you know, most of the components are zero. And in fact, it's, you know, it's just a bunch of stuff that's either plus or minus one multiplying the square root of g. And the point is that by doing all of this, we essentially end up with the same sort of thing that we had over here. At least we recognize that the d3y is common to each thing. Okay, well, how do we go about this? Well, the first thing we need to understand is that, well, this vector, if it's going to agree with that thing over here, this vector should point in the direction of the normal vector. And that's something that can be understood really easily, because that quantity on the right-hand side cannot have a component along either E1, E2, or E3. And that's sort of easy to see, because if you, for example, look at that quantity and you ask, can this have a component along E1? Well, you would answer the question by working out the inner product of that vector with E1. And when you look at this and you recognize that this product of things here is symmetric under an exchange of mu and alpha, and you recognize that this is antisymmetric under the same exchange, you see that, in fact, that inner product has to be zero. And that's going to be true for E1, it's going to be true for E3, and 2, and it's going to be true for E3 as well. So all inner products of that vector here with any one of the tangent vectors has to be zero, and the only vector that we have left in the basis is a normal vector. So immediately, we know that this quantity has to be proportional to the normal vector. And that's sort of, you know, starting to suggest that, well, there's some relationship between this quantity right here and the more general one, or the, you know, the more, you know, strange one that I just defined. So what I'm going to do is to define the right-hand side to be some scalar function that I'll call epsilon f multiplying the normal vector. So that's just the statement that this vector over here on the left-hand side has to be proportional to the normal vector, and the quantity in front is just that, you know, proportionality factor. And how do I calculate this? How do I calculate f? Well, what I'm going to do is to take the inner product with the normal vector, and I'm going to bring down an f, and I'm going to have a factor of n multiplying n, and the norm of n is epsilon, you know. Epsilon is that plus or minus one quantity that we introduced before. It has no relationship with the tensorial epsilon, but epsilon gives that suggestion that it's something that alternates depending on the situation. So to calculate f, all we have to do is to work out what that is. And to work out what that is, well, requires a little bit of work, but we have all the information we need to actually do this. And, well, we can just do it. I'm going to go through this calculation in some detail because I think it brings out some clever ways of doing calculations sometimes that are, I think, worthwhile knowing. I mean, this is the kind of calculation that works here. This is the type of strategy that works well in this case, but you know, it's the kind of strategy that can be adapted to other similar calculations. And the strategy is based on recognizing that what we're evaluating here in F is a scalar function. And that to evaluate a scalar, I can pick any coordinate system that I want. And if I get a value for that coordinate system, it's going to be, you know, the same value for any coordinate system. So the key to the calculation is going to be to find a really good coordinate system that's going to allow us, to do this calculation in the simplest possible way. So we need to calculate F as defined in this way, but we have the freedom of doing this calculation in any coordinate system, and I'm going to pick a coordinate system that's going to be really, really simple for the purpose of doing this calculation. Okay. We have a bunch of coordinates YA on the hypersurface, and I've already selected those. So what I don't have freedom over is, so once I've made a choice for here, you know, the tangent vectors are fully specified, so I don't have the freedom really in this calculation of redefining the y coordinates. The freedom that I have is to pick the space-time coordinates, the x alphas. The yas, I'm going to assume, are fixed. What I'm going to choose in this calculation are the space-time coordinates, the x alphas. And I might as well decide that three of them are going to be in agreement with the YAs, right? And then all I have to do is to pick, you know, a fourth coordinate or a zeroth coordinate that's going to be, you know, a good choice. And what I'm going to pick for X naught is the value of phi. Phi is constant on the hypersurface, but it changes as we move off the hypersurface. So I can use that as a coordinate that will take me off the hypersurface. All the other coordinates are leaving me within the hypersurface. If I want to go off the hypersurface, I need another coordinate, and why not choose phi? So in this coordinate system, my surface is a surface of constant phi, but it's also the surface x naught equals a constant. X naught. So the new specification of the surface is that sigma, the hypersurface is a surface x naught equals zero, and the coordinates that I choose to pick on the hypersurface agree with the space-time coordinates. Well, in fact, I'm doing it the other way around. I've picked those first, and then, you know, irrespective of the coordinates I used to have in the space-time, I'm going to change them and make sure that the spatial coordinates agree with those spatial coordinates. Yep. So I'm using the notation. Yeah, so for concreteness, I'm choosing a space-like surface, and the coordinate that goes off is a time-like coordinate. But you know, it's just, you know, I could call this x3 if I wanted to; it wouldn't make any difference. So the signs tend to be a little bit of an irritation here because you have to sort of keep track of them, but it's not that big of a deal. You just have to be a little bit careful about that. Okay, so the point is that we're going to pick this coordinate system, and you're going to see that the advantage of choosing phi as a coordinate is actually pretty a pretty good one. Why is it a good one? Well, mostly because an alpha is proportional to the gradient of phi. And if I choose phi as one of my coordinates, well, this is something that will have only an entry along the phi direction and no entry whatsoever along the other spatial directions. That's what it means to choose phi as one of the coordinates. I have to worry a little bit about the normalization of n. That's going to enter the calculation because, you know, whatever normalization I have for n will impact this calculation right here. So I need to work this out. So what I'm going to say is that n is not only proportional to this, but it's got to be equal to that up to some factor. So I'm going to say that it's going to be equal to some factor mu times the gradient of phi, which means that in components, it's going to be that factor mu times, you know, entry 1, 0, 0, 0. To calculate mu, I have to normalize. I'm going to say that epsilon has to be g alpha beta multiplying n alpha n beta. And because n alpha in this coordinate system only has one entry, what I'm going to pick out here is only the g naught naught component to the metric or the g phi phi component to the metric times mu squared. Yeah. Just hold on a sec. I lost track of my argument here. Okay. No, that's fine. So essentially what I wanted to do with this is just to say that that gives me a way of solving for mu in terms of everything else. So mu is going to be 1 over the square root of g naught naught. And there's an epsilon that should be in there somewhere, but here is where it gets really irritating to keep track of all the epsilons. So I think so there should be absolute values here, and there should be an epsilon over there. So that's just to keep track of the signs. Don't worry too much about it. So I need an absolute value inside the square root to make sure that, you know, the inside of the square root is actually positive. And then to just keep, you know, to have the signs do the right thing, I need to throw in the factor of epsilon over here. If you're not too clear about this, and, you know, I'm not being very clear about it, just go through the calculation carefully, maybe in the two different cases, just to be sure that, you know, you can keep track of the signs. Okay, so that's the expression for mu and the expression for the only non-vanishing entry to the normal vector. I'm going to need the normal, so to calculate that thing over here, I'm going to need the normal vector with the index up. So we need to evaluate this. So, well, we know about that. This only, so the sum over here will only pick up one term because only, so n naught is the only non-vanishing component. So we get this equation right here. And what else do I need to tell you? Okay. I don't know the off-diagonal components of the metric at this stage, but I don't need to know them because I'll just, in fact, for the rest of the calculation, only need n naught. So let's evaluate this first, and then you'll see why it's only the component. It's only that component is required. So that component of n naught with the index up is this combination here. And then, so what we got over here is, so I have a g naught naught over here. I have one under the square root over here. So again, if you keep track of all the signs, you find that it's the square root of absolute value of g naught naught. Okay. So what do we do with this? Well, F is the Levi-Civita tensor multiplied by N multiplied by E1, E2, and E3. Because of this choice of coordinates, the E's are very simple. They're just connector deltas. Right? So E1 will be non-vanishing, so the alpha component of E1 will only have a non-vanishing component along the one entry, this along the two entry, and this along the three entry. So what I really have here is mu, the Levi-Civita tensor, mu alpha beta gamma times n mu, but I can replace alpha by one, beta by two, and gamma by three. Which means that the only term, the only non-zero term in this sum is going to involve mu equals zero. And at this stage, we're almost done, because at this stage, we have the square root of the full metric determinant times n naught, which is the square root of g00. Well, we still need to work a little bit on that, because now I have everything worked out in terms of the full metric, but I want to relate this to the three-dimensional induced metric on the hypersurface. How do I do that? Well, this is a component of the inverse metric, and we have to remember how to invert matrices. What's the structure of the matrix, of the metric arranged in the matrix, where we're going to have G0 over here, we're going to have G0A over here, G0A over here, and GAB down here, but GAB, because we're putting the spatial coordinates equal to the YA coordinates, the GAB entry in the metric is actually the HAB induced metric. How do I calculate the inverse element to the 0, 0 entry? Do you remember that? Right. So what do I do? So how do I do that? Right. So I eliminate this column and this row, and I calculate the rest of the determinant, which is the determinant of HAB. And then, of course, I divide by the full determinant of the metric. So what do we got? We got an expression for G naught naught. And if we put everything under the square root and forget about signs for a second, we get GH G. The G's cancel out, and what survives is the square root of H. So at this stage, having made this, sort of intelligent use of coordinates and coordinate freedom, we have the statement that F is equal to square root of H. And if we go back to that expression over here, we get that our original vector in whatever coordinate system, so when I multiply, so when I go back to this expression over here, I get epsilon F, which is epsilon square root of H times n mu. And the quantity that I started with was that multiplied by d3y. That's the definition that I gave over here. And what this boils down to is this. So I'm sorry, I wasn't very clear in the derivation here, and I didn't present it very well. But the point is this. So the point is that we can quickly, we can immediately, so the whole point, so the calculation goes as follows. So this is a vector on the right-hand side that obviously has to be orthogonal to any one of the three tangent vectors, and therefore has to be in the direction of the vector n. So that gives us the first equation that we had over here that says that the vector in question has to be in the direction of n, and what appears in front is a scalar. We work out an expression for the scalar, first in completely covariant form, and then we say, okay, well, it's a scalar quantity. Let's evaluate it in some coordinate system that's convenient for our purposes. I made a choice of coordinates where all the spatial coordinates agree with the coordinates on the hypersurface, and the zeroth coordinate is going to be just the function phi. That allowed me to immediately identify the components of the normal vector in that coordinate system very simply. And when you continue and work out all the details, you find that in that coordinate system, f evaluates simply to a square root of the spatial determinant of the induced metric. That's a result that's valid in the coordinate system that I chose, but of course, we're calculating a scalar function as far as the space-time coordinates are concerned. Therefore, the result is valid in all coordinate systems once I've made a choice for the YA coordinates. If I start, changing those, of course, D3Y is going to change and H is going to change along the, according to the usual rules. But the game here is that, I play around with the space-time coordinates because they don't, the scalar does not care. And in that simple coordinate system, I get this result. This is a true result that's going to be valid in all coordinate systems. And at the end of the day, I have this result right here that the quantity that I defined formally over there in terms of the Levi-Civita tensor, after working it out and reducing it down to things that are familiar from the hypersurface, we reproduce the volume element on the hypersurface. We reproduce the fact that it's directed along the normal vector. The only new thing that we get is an epsilon. So that comes for free in the process of doing the calculation. I could have removed that by putting it in initially, but I certainly don't want to do that. I'm going to live with it over there because I certainly don't want it here. And the reason why I don't want it here is because while I could put it here, if all I'm interested in is to define volume elements on space-like or time-like surfaces, but the whole point of this construction is that it survives the limit where you go to the null case. If I stuck in a factor of epsilon over here, well, what's epsilon when the surface is null? Well, I don't know. It's zero or it's plus or minus one. I don't know. I would generate an ambiguity that's not needed, not required, not wanted. So I'm going to live with the epsilon over here, over there. For the time-like case, it's a little bit annoying because that means that the fundamental surface element on a space, so if I have a space-like surface, the normal vector, if you make a sensible choice, you would choose to point in the future direction. But epsilon is negative, which means that this vector actually points in the past. That's clumsy, that's not terribly attractive, but, we're going to have to live with that. For the space-like case, if the normal is space-like, then epsilon is positive. And here we have our usual notion that the vectorial surface element actually points in the same direction as the normal, as opposed to the opposite direction. So in this case, d sigma mu points in that way. In this case, it points that way, as we would sort of hope and expect. But the epsilon is something that has to be there in the time-like space-like case if we don't put it in over there. And I don't want it over there, because when you look at this and you ask what happens when this takes over to the null case, the point is that nothing happens. This has a very gentle continuous limit. Nothing goes wrong with that. nothing goes wrong with the tangent vectors except for one becoming, well, except, no. So all the tangent vectors stay tangent vectors. There's no problem there. The normal vector has become tangential also. That's no matter. It doesn't appear here. So this is a construction that actually carries over to the null case. This will give us our notion of surface element on the null case, something that we didn't know how to formulate before. Here we have a handle on that. And where is this coming from? Well, I told you before, this is essentially a pullback of volume four forms down to a three-dimensional surface. And that's something that works, you know, no matter what type of surface you're dealing with. So any subtleties or mysteries about what I've done here? Okay, so let's look at the null case. And I won't go through derivation like this again because, you know, I think that's once is enough. And, you know, the strategy would be very similar. But what I want to do is to examine what happens to that when we are explicitly in the null situation. So let's see, I'll get rid of... So let's look at the null case. So the claim is that this has a well-defined limit, well-behaved limit in the limit where you take your time-like surface and make it null. So we won't need to change the definition. All that I want to do is to try to understand what this means in terms of quantities we've talked about previously. So in the null case, we're going to be dealing with that sort of preferred coordinate system that I talked about this morning that's well adapted to the description of the null generators of the hypersurface. So we have the null generators. We have the cross curves. We have, you know, one of the tangential vectors that's now going to be aligned with K. And we have the other two that are orthogonal to K in the proper sense of the word. We have the vector n that sticks out of the hypersurface, and then we have this commitment that we're going to use lambda and theta a as our three-dimensional coordinates. And we also have the assignment that the vector e1 is going to be k, and we're going to have the two other vectors being, you know, derivatives of the space-time coordinates with respect to the generator labels theta 2 and theta 3. So when I specialize this expression to this situation, what I find this time is that the surface element on the hypersurface, I'm going to write it this way, involves a contraction of the Levi-Civita tensor in the direction of K, which replaces E1. And apart from that, we have E2 and E3. And D3y will now be written as D lambda D2 theta. And what we have is a suggestion that there's a nice split between a surface element that's really a two-dimensional surface element, and that's going to be the surface element in the space transverse to the null generators, times, you know, a third dimensional, you know, the third dimension, the integration along the third dimension, which is an integration along the null generators in the direction of the parameter lambda. So to make that a little bit more clear, what I'm going to do is to package things a little bit differently. And I'm going to put in the null vector over here. I'm going to introduce a quantity with two indices as an element of two-dimensional surface. And I'm going to multiply this by d lambda. So d sigma mu in all case will be written in this form, and ds mu nu is going to be what's left over. So in the language of forms, what we're dealing with here with ds mu nu is a pullback of the volume 4 form down to a two-dimensional surface, the cross-sections of the congruence of null generators. So as we keep lambda fixed, we're defining a transverse space that's going to be two-dimensional, the transverse space to the congruence. This, is a two-dimensional surface on the null hypersurface, and this, is in fact a notion of surface element on those two-dimensional surfaces. So when we go from space-time down to a three-dimensional hypersurface, we go from a scalar volume element to a vectorial surface element, and now we're going down an additional dimension from 4 to 3 to 2, and each time we go down, we bring out an additional index. So the volume element in four-dimensional space-time is a scalar quantity, and three-dimensional surface, it's a vectorial quantity. And here we have a tensorial quantity, which is antisymmetric under its two indices. And it's antisymmetric because it's a two-form on the two-dimensional surface. And I'm using the form language only if it's something that appeals to you. I don't need you to rely on that because we're going to show, it's clear that it's anti-symmetric, and either you understand this because it's a property of forms, or you just recognize that this is something that just follows from the construction. And when you write it in this form, I think you do have the suggestion that the way of understanding the surface integration in a null case is to think of it as a split between the two-dimensional integration in the cross, in the transverse space of the congruence, combined with an integration along the flow of the congruence, an integration with respect to lambda. That's how you integrate over a null hypersurface. You take care of the transverse directions first, and then you integrate that along the flow of the generators. There's a way of writing this down in a way that that relates to the conventional notions that we've introduced before, not the conventional notions, but all of the language that we've introduced this morning. I'll just write down the answer. I won't give you a derivation of this because, it follows essentially the same lines that we went through when we were working this this quantity out for the time-like case. It's a similar type of calculation. But I'll just point out that this quantity right here can be expressed more simply in terms of the vector k, in terms of the vector n, in this antisymmetric combination right here, in terms of the determinant of the two-dimensional metric on the transverse space times d2 theta. So remember, on the null hypersurface, we have a metric that is essentially two-dimensional. So as far as the metric is concerned, there's no space-time direction along the direction of the congruence. So you only generate a space-time interval in the transverse direction. So the transverse space has a metric. And what I've done here is to just define sigma to be the determinant of that two-dimensional metric. So it's the two-dimensional determinant instead of the three-dimensional determinant that would be zero in this case. And while you can understand where this equation comes from, first of all, there's the requirement that this quantity right here, and that's a property that's inherited directly from the Levi-Civita tensor, that is antisymmetric in mu and nu, which means that if the right-hand side involves k mu and n nu, it has to be involving them in this antisymmetric combination. So it's easy to understand why it's the antisymmetric combination of k mu and nu that enters in the definition or in the expression for the surface element. I should specify that this is a 2D surface element. Another feature here is that, well, this tensor only has components along K and N. And that follows for the same reason that we had in a time-like case. This tensor has to be orthogonal to E2, and it has to be orthogonal to E3 for the same reason. There's no component along E2 nor E3 because of the, you know, symmetry versus antisymmetry property that we have up here. So if you eliminate components along E2 and E3, you've ruled out the transverse space, and the only components that are left are going to be orthogonal to the transverse space. And that means that you need an element along K. I mean, you have the potential of having elements along K and N. And in fact, well, that's how it occurs, because it could be no other combination. It couldn't be K and K, because that would not be antisymmetric. It could not be N and N. Because also it would be it couldn't be antisymmetric. So the only possibility really for the tensorial structure of that thing is that it be this antisymmetric combination of K and N. That the rest of it works out with a factor of 2 here and a determinant of the two-dimensional metric, well, that's something that has to be justified by the calculation. The calculation is, you know, more or less following the same lines. You try to form a scalar out of this by multiplying by the appropriate vectors, and then you have a scalar, you choose coordinate systems that are, you know, adapted to this situation. I go through that in the notes, and at the end you get that it's really the two-dimensional determinant that enters in the final result. You had a question, right?
I think you just, it's both about that notation. You're saying that, like, the square brackets, that it's anti-symmetric.
Right. Right. So by definition, if you have a tensor and you antisymmetrize it, it's 1/2 of the tensor minus the transpose of the tensor. So that's just the notation. And round brackets would be the same thing, except you would have a plus sign, and that would be this symmetrization of the tensor. Other questions about this? Okay, so what we can do is to, combine the two expressions and see what we get. So let's plug that into our previous expression for d sigma mu. So we get k nu. That multiplies what we just found for ds mu nu. And if I work it out in full, I get k mu n nu minus n mu k nu. And we have square root of sigma d2 theta d lambda. And at this stage, something really nice happens. I seem to have a minus sign I don't want. Oh, no, I get it. So it's there. So k multiplying n gives me a minus 1. K multiplying k gives me a 0. So what we end up with in the end, in the null case, is the same minus sign that we had in the time-like case that sort of survives in the limit. We have that the directed surface element is still going to be in the direction of the normal vector, even though the normal vector is also tangent to the surface. And we get the rest of it. We get the two-dimensional surface element, and we get the longitudinal bit that allows us to integrate along the flow of the congruence. So at this stage, you know, it starts to look plausible again. I mean, it's more or less, well, it's similar, analogous to what we got for the time-like case, except for the fact that here we've bypassed the problem with the three-dimensional metric being degenerate. We automatically get something that involves only the two-dimensional surface sorry, the two-dimensional metric on the topologically three-dimensional surface, hypersurface, and we get a directed surface element that is really directed along the normal vector, and it really doesn't matter that the normal is also tangent. It's the appropriate direction for the surface element to be in. It's not obvious that it should be that. I mean, you could have expected, you could have guessed that in the end, the directed surface element should have been in the direction of n. That would have been sensible. But if you believe in this, and you should, then the result guarantees that the directed surface element is going to be in the direction of k. And the reason why you should believe in that is because, while this is really the primitive construction, the primitive definition that doesn't care about the signature of the hypersurface, it works in all cases. And that's the end result when the surface is null. All right? So that's, just a sec. So essentially, those are the ingredients that you need to integrate on a hypersurface. And one thing to point out is that, well, what are you allowed to integrate on a hypersurface? On a hypersurface, because the vectorial surface element, because the surface element is really defined as a vector, you can integrate a vector. You could not integrate a tensor, or you cannot integrate a scalar, because you would not have another index to kill off that index. And it's only something that emerges as a scalar that can be added at different points. And this is the type of quantity that can be integrated. So you can integrate vectors on a hypersurface, and that's it. So in space-time, you can integrate scalars. On a hypersurface, you can integrate a vector. And on a two-surface, so this is in 4D, this is in 3D, this is in 2D, on the surface, you have to integrate a tensor because you need to kill off those two indices. And that tensor, if it had a symmetric part, the integral would not care. This being antisymmetric means that only the antisymmetric piece of a tensor will actually contribute to the integral. So in a sense, you can integrate a two-dimensional antisymmetric tensor. You can integrate on a two-dimensional surface, you can integrate an antisymmetric tensor. And anything that's not antisymmetric, anything that would have a symmetric piece to that, actually would not contribute to the integral. Someone had a question. You had a question? Yep. Over here.
Why is not NK?
So why is it that, and why do we get a minus sign over here? All I can say is that this is what comes out of the calculation. So once you've committed to, we've committed to a sign convention over here. And that sign convention is actually carried on in the rest of the calculation. And when you actually do the calculation, you find that, well, this is what you get. And there's no other justification, because whatever sign you get over here, well, is inherited from the definition, right? So the way I understand it is that I can think of this as being what happens when you take the limit from a time-like direction to a null direction, and the minus sign we had in a time-like case survives in the limit. Of course, if you look at it the other way, and you take the limit from the space-like direction, then, well, you don't see why there should be a minus sign that appears in limit. So basically, I just told you that I don't understand where it comes from. But that's just how it goes. Nothing very deep about this. It's mostly conventional. And certainly, the advantage of starting from over here starting from that definition of directed surface element is the fact that this is a notion that doesn't care about the signature of the spacetime. It will work no matter what your hypersurface is. And if it happens to be a time-like surface, you have that extra minus sign. If it happens to be a space-like surface, sorry, it's the other way around. If the normal is time-like, you have this extra minus sign. If the normal is space-like, you don't. And if the surface is null, you do. Could you have the freedom of getting rid of this minus sign if you don't like it after the fact? Sure, why not? You would change the convention after the fact, and perhaps for your purposes, that would not create any difficulty. And if you stick with time-like surfaces, space-like surfaces, time-like normals, you could also kill the extra minus sign. It wouldn't hurt you particularly. So, you know, there's issues of convention that are not terribly important here. But if you want to start from a sort of unified treatment where you start from one definition that can be applied to all possible situations, well, then you have to, you know, carry the minus signs around and you have to live with them. That's basically what it is. Other questions? Yep?
I got lost with some of the nature of these things. So if we go back to the time-like space-like thing.
Yep.
The d sigma u is a factor.
Right.
It's proportional to nu. Nu is certainly a factor.
Right.
So that means when multiplies, it has to be a scalar. When multiplies, it's square root of determinant of h times d cubed y.
Right.
Now, determinant of square root of determinant h, you argue, is a scalar. So I have to understand d cubed y as a scalar.
Okay.
Am I mixing up scalar and the hypers?
Yeah, that's exactly the key. So, yeah, very good, because I don't think I made that clear before. We have the space-time view, where we'll call a scalar and a vector and a tensor things that change in a certain way when we change those coordinates. We have the hypersurface view, where we'll call a scalar or a vector or a tensor things that change on the coordinate transformations of the purely y coordinates. And those are not the same notions of, you know, of tensors in each case. So I can have a quantity like HAB defined to be the inner product between the tangent vectors. This quantity is obviously a tensor as far as the hypersurface view is concerned. But as far as the space-time view is concerned, this is just a set of scalar quantities. Because if you change the space-time coordinates, you'll change the metric, but you'll also change the tangent vectors. And the combination will be a scalar as far as the space-time coordinates are concerned. So this quantity is a scalar in space-time. It's a set of scalars in space-time, but it's a tensor on the hypersurface. So you just repeat that story for whatever object you're interested in. So you're, you know, so the, you know, that quantity right here, that is a scalar in the hypersurface. It's also a scalar in space-time, so here there's no distinction because it's a scalar in each case. Okay. Yep. Sorry.
Determinant of any metric is a
scalar. No. So the this or the determinant by itself is not a scalar. So this is something that will change under coordinate transformation, and in fact, the way it changes is dictated by the Jacobian rule. And the way to understand this is just to remember that, you know, if you change coordinates, you have a coordinate transformation law that relates metric components into coordinate system that way. If you take the determinant of this equation, you'll get So you have a product of three matrices here. So when you take a determinant, you get the product of the determinants. The determinant of this is a Jacobian. The determinant of that is another Jacobian. So you get J squared, and you get the determinant of the metric in the prime coordinate system. So the way that the determinant changes is dictated by the Jacobian. And that was the whole point of combining this with this, because this changes with the Jacobian. This changes by a factor involving the Jacobian, which is compensated by that. And that's why the combination is a scalar. So it's the combination that's a scalar, not each piece separately. Somebody else had a question. Did you have a question? Yeah. Yep. Oh, okay. So I was using fancy language that perhaps some of you relates to, but the idea is this. So if you have a vector in space-time or a metric in space-time, let's think about a metric. So suppose that you have a tensor in space-time, and what you do is to evaluate it on the hypersurface, then that defines the pullback of that tensor on the hypersurface. So I guess my answer was very upsetting. Yeah.
Is the phi
Right. Yeah. No, you're right. And in fact, in the book, I actually spent some time discussing this. I didn't want to go into that now because it's not terribly interesting. But certainly, when you go back to that expression, there's a sign convention that is introduced by choosing an ordering for the three vectors, right? So, so for example, in ordinary three-dimensional calculus, you would choose a right-handed system, x, y, and z, and you would have an ordering that's consistent with the right-handedness of the basis, and that gives you a sign convention on the vectorial surface element. If I were to choose a different ordering, I may or may not break the right-handedness of my basis, and that would introduce additional minus signs. So yeah, so there is a convention here in the ordering of the y1, y2, y3 coordinates, and that convention, of course, you know, means that those signs are going to be carried over in the rest of the calculation. So in the book, I actually give you I actually specify what the convention is, and sometimes it's a little bit strange. Depending on the situation. For example, if you're dealing with, I don't want to discuss it. It's sort of tedious and not interesting. But those sign issues and those conventional issues, I think, are a source of confusion. I mean, if you do a calculation, you may end up with the wrong sign in the end somewhere because you haven't thought carefully, or you've sort of discounted minus signs where they're important, and it's possible that the minus sign will carry over to a place where you really don't want it and where it gives you sort of meaningless results. So if you are ever doing a calculation involving surface elements, you have to pay some attention to that, but I think at this stage, for our purposes here, I don't think we need to belabor that too much. Other questions? Okay, so I think I have what I need here in terms of having defined surface elements on a hypersurface, but also on a two-dimensional hypersurface, on a two-dimensional surface in a four-dimensional space-time. So this gives me a very good notion of two-dimensional surface element. And here we have, a notion of three-dimensional surface element. And those are the type of things that I'll involve in more interesting things as we proceed forward with that. But I think it's important to understand where this is all coming from. And, if you find that this discussion was a little bit too sketchy and not very clear, I think I may agree with you. And I'll invite you to consult the notes, because there all the details are provided. Let's see, what time is it? Five. Okay, so I think I have time to talk about two important integration theorems, one being the Gauss theorem, and the other one is Stokes. And it turns out that, well, they can be formulated very neatly with the tools we have right now. Oh, it's her cell phone. Okay, so the Gauss integration theorem is really well known from three-dimensional vector calculus, and here, well, it looks very similar. So what we have is a closed volume in space-time, so we have a three-dimensional volume that's enclosed by a hypersurface. And I never talked to a soundtrack before. That's that's pretty good. Yeah, it's really good.
You should have dramatic music going, and then when you do the
theorem. That's right. Yeah, no, good idea. I'll think about that. Okay, and the statement of the theorem says that what you can do is to integrate the divergence of a vector over space-time, over this region of space-time, so I'll call it dv. And you can, in fact, express the result of the integral in terms of a surface integral over sigma, and because it's a closed surface, I'll use the usual sign for closed integration, where you take the normal component of the vector and integrate that over the closed hypersurface. So that's Gauss's theorem. In the notes, I give you a proof of that. And again, the proof involves a clever choice of coordinates, which is well adapted to a situation like this. So essentially, you use this closed surface as a level surface of, you know, of a nest of surfaces. So essentially, you adapt the coordinate system to this surface, and then a whole nest of similar surfaces within the volume. Anyway, don't worry about the details. I don't want to go through the proof over here, but I'll just indicate why the proof is really very simple. And in fact, the proof, you know, there's a version of the proof which I don't give in the notes, which would be virtually identical to what you would get from, you know, the elementary proofs that you would have learned about, you know, in vector calculus. And the key is the fact that when you calculate the divergence of a vector in space-time, you can do that in a way that involves only partial derivatives. So the statement of the result over here could be written purely in terms of partial derivatives. And the factor of root g that appears here appears also over here. So as far as the integral is concerned, there's a root g over here, there's a root g there that cancel out. And the what lives inside the integral is a partial derivative. And that's exactly the type of thing that, well, you know, that would be involved in a sort of elementary statement of Gauss's theorem. And because the formulation of the theorem is identical to the old one, except for being in four dimensions instead of three, well, I think you can imagine that the proof would proceed in a very similar way. So you can prove it along elementary means like that, or you can, you know, think of fancier techniques based on the coordinate freedom that's associated with the result, because, you know, what we have here is a scalar, what we have there is a scalar, and therefore you can evaluate each side of the equality in any coordinate system you wish. So that's the type of proof that I present in the notes. But in any case, there's nothing more to Gauss's theorem in four-dimensional space-time than what there is in three-dimensional vector calculus. So for those reasons, I don't think I need to go through the proof. But a statement, I think, of the theorem is very intuitive, and I think it's very plausible. You get that the covariant divergence of a vector integrated over a four-dimensional volume is equal to the integral of its normal component on the boundary. And, I think that's very plausible. I don't think it requires additional justification. One thing to keep in mind is that this volume element is going to be defined. So, for example, the surface phi that I was talking about before would be this closed surface. And what we would imagine here is that there would be another level surface below that would be a surface of phi being negative, and there would be another level surface above on which phi would be positive. So the normal vector and the normal surface element is defined to be pointing in directions of increasing phi. So what we have automatically in the construction is the notion that we're dealing here with an outward surface element. It's always pointing away from the interior to the exterior of the surface. All right. So that's the statement of Gauss's theorem. There's also a statement of a Stokes theorem. And here I have to watch my factors of two. The Stokes theorem says something like this. So now we start from how do I want to draw this? I want to start from some, so it's a segment of a hypersurface that's bounded by two-dimensional boundary. So we have a three-dimensional surface and the boundary of that, so we have a segment of a hypersurface and the boundary of that is a two-dimensional closed surface. So that's the usual situation that we're familiar with in vector calculus. You have a three-dimensional surface bounded by some closed two-dimensional surface. And the statement of the theorem here says that if we take an antisymmetric tensor field B, and we integrate this over the hypersurface, then we can relate this to the integration over the boundary of the antisymmetric tensor field integrated over the surface. It's key here that we're dealing with an antisymmetric tensor field. If we didn't have that, the result would not be true. The reason why the antisymmetry property is important is the fact that for an antisymmetric tensor field, we can also express the covariant divergence of that tensor field in this form. If we had a tensor with no symmetries or a symmetric tensor, there would be an extra term involving gamma multiplying B. And gamma is symmetric, B might have a symmetric part, and that would contribute to the right-hand side. When B is antisymmetric and gamma is symmetric, then that extra term makes no contribution, and we get this relation. And this relation is why performing this integral is, in fact, well, the same thing as what you would do in ordinary calculus, where you replace all covariant derivatives by partial derivatives. So again, I give you a a proof of this in the notes, and this is perhaps a little bit familiar, less familiar looking than the previous one, but this can be proved more or less along the same lines that I proved the other result over here, and it's also something that can be proved along the same lines that Stokes' theorem is proved in three-dimensional calculus. Of course, in three-dimensional vector calculus, Gauss's theorem involves a three-dimensional volume bounded by a two-dimensional surface. So here we moved up one dimension, but that creates no difficulty whatsoever. The usual formulation of Stokes' theorem in three-dimensional vector calculus goes, involves a two-dimensional surface bounded by a circumference. So again, we've moved up one dimension. We formulated a little bit differently from the usual formulation of Stokes' theorem in terms of a curl of a vector. Here we don't have the curl operation as defined in space-time, so we don't do it like that. But what replaces the curl is the antisymmetric property of the tensor field. So you can see that in essence we're sort of reproducing the usual formulation of Gauss and Stokes. If you are familiar with forms, you probably will suspect that this comes from a very pretty identity that says that if you're integrating a form over a boundary, this is like integrating the exterior derivative of the form over over the region. So this is this is one of the prettiest equations of mathematics. If you know forms, you know about this. So this is defined as a form. This is the exterior derivative of that form. And the general formulation of Gauss's theorem in that case says that integrating the derivative of the form is the same thing as integrating the form over the boundary. And there's no denying that this is a very pretty equation. I don't think I messed it up here. And what we have here is a more concrete, formulation of that identity when we go from four dimensions to three dimensions, and then when we go from three dimensions to two dimensions. And the form structure is also has to do with the fact that is really the fundamental reason why we're dealing here with antisymmetric tensor fields. That's what a form is. So that would be d alpha in that particular context. I have to confess that I prefer the uglier versions of those equations because they're more concrete to me. When I'm presented with that equation, I never know what to do with it. I know I'm supposed to do something with it, but I never know what. Whereas here, I sort of know what I need to do with that. I just plug in the previous expression I had for the vectorial surface elements. I know what my tensor fields are. I know how to integrate. Here, if I really, taught myself again how to deal with these things, I would, I would be able to handle it. But there's a few steps of abstraction involved here that that I would need to undo if I wanted to use this in a practical calculation. So pretty equations are pretty, but they're not necessarily useful unless you're very familiar with this this kind of formalism. Okay, so let me do one last thing before we quit, because I want to talk about conservation identities. So one very major application of Gauss's theorem is to formulate conservation statements, like charge conservation, like things like that, charge or mass conservation in different contexts. So suppose we have a vector that might represent, for example, the current density in space-time, so that would be the current density of a distribution of charge in space-time. And we know that the statement of differential, the differential statement of charge conservation is the statement that the covariant divergence of that vector should be zero in spacetime. And the point is that this is something that can be rewritten as a conservation statement for something which, in this case, will correspond to total charge. So the idea is this. So suppose that I integrate this over, first of all, an arbitrary region in spacetime. I'm going to be integrating this over a volume V bounded by a surface sigma. Well, if I do that, I'm going to get that 0 is equal to the spacetime volume integration of this over the region V. But I know that this is going to be equal to the surface integral of J over the whole boundary. So that's a general statement, that the closed boundary integral of J is going to be 0. Suppose that I specialize now to a situation where I give you more details and on the four-dimensional region. So suppose that my V I pick to be bounded above by, you know, some space-like hypersurface and bounded below by some other hypersurface. So this is a surface of constant time, say T1. This is a a surface of constant time T naught, and here I define this to be very loosely, I define this very loosely by just saying that we're talking about one space-like hypersurface and another one space-like hypersurface. Now, the formation of the theorem involves a closed boundary, so I have to close the surface, but what I'm going to do is to introduce the boundaries, the spatial boundaries. They're here, but they're really pushed out as far as I can make it. So I'm going to push them out to infinity. I'm not going to take the limit just now. So I'm going to take the limit in the end, but not just yet, because before I take the limit, I still have, strictly speaking, a closed boundary. But if I think of taking a limit eventually, I can, specialize my J to be such that, outside of some bounded region in space-time, J is going to vanish. So I'm going to have a bounded distribution of a charge, and eventually I'm going to get out of it. And when I get out of it, when my spatial boundary is far enough away from where the charge actually lives in space-time, I'm not going to pick up the contribution from the spatial boundaries on this. So when you specialize it to this type of situation, what you find is that, well, the boundary integral will involve an integration over the upper boundary and an integration over the lower boundary. So let me indicate this as an integration over T1 plus an integration over T0. Here's where the sign issue will appear. But it will take care of itself very nicely. This is the normal vector to the hypersurface N1, T1. And I'm going to choose it to be future pointing. This is going to be the normal to the surface T0, and I'm choosing it also to be future pointing. With all the signs that we've introduced today, the sigma is pointing. The sigma is actually pointing in. That's fine. That's what it does. It's pointing in both directions. That's not obvious. Let me explain. This is the surface phi equals zero. This is the surface phi equals one. This is the surface phi equals minus one. According to the conventions that we've introduced, d sigma points in the direction opposite the direction of the normal vector, which is defined to be pointing in the direction in which phi increases. So the normal to that surface defined to be such that that it increases away from in the direction of increasing phi is going to be pointing everywhere outward. And d sigma is going to be pointing in the opposite direction, which is everywhere inward. So if I describe my closed surface by an equation such as phi equals zero, and I decide that that a surface outside of it is going to be where phi increases, then the outward normal goes that way, everywhere outward, and d sigma is going to be everywhere opposite to that. Well, not everywhere, only when it's a space like sigma, anyway. The reason why I'm hesitating is because, you know, there's a time-like segment that there's a space-like segment that starts here and ends here, and there's, you know, a space-like segment over here. So the behavior is sort of changing a little bit strangely here. But the point is that, I think that tells us enough to know that on this part of the boundary and on this part of the boundary, d sigma has to point inward. And if I choose my unit normal to be in that direction here and in this direction here we have agreement between the two directions. Here we have disagreement. And that's the minus sign I needed. You have a question?
Why do you need to worry about the space-like or
time-like? Here I don't. But in that diagram over here, I sort of painted myself in a corner where the issue became important. Yeah, those signs are, you know, a real pain to keep track of. But anyway, so I think we see where the minus sign that I was looking for is going to arise. It's going to arise from the fact that we have agreement here and disagreement there. So for this guy, what I can do is to say that we're going to have an integral, over n1. So I'm going to introduce a minus sign over here. And this surface element is going to be the normal vector n1 times d sigma. And for this guy, we have agreement, so we have a plus sign. And here we have n0, alpha, d sigma. And the point of all this is that, well, we have managed to turn the vanishing of the divergence of the vector into an integral statement of charge conservation. So this quantity right here would be interpreted as the total charge present at time t1. This would be the total charge present at times t2. And what we have here is the statement that the total charge is the same at t1 and t0. And, that's what we mean by charge conservation. So we can turn that equation over here with Gauss's theorem. We can turn this differential statement of conservation into a statement of actual conservation for something. Now, I'll say one more thing and then I'll quit. And in fact, I won't even say anything. I'll just ask you to think about this. This is a statement that normally is said to represent energy momentum conservation in curved space-time. Is there a conserved quantity associated with that? The answer next week. No, we have reading week. We have winter break next week. So what's your feeling? I mean, is that something that I could turn into an integral statement of conservation? Is there a total momentum quantity that could be obtained from this expression? Taylor, you had a... Yeah. So, any suggestion? Well, the answer is no. Because there's no way I can integrate this over space-time because it's a tensor. I mean, it's a vector. So this is not something I'm allowed to integrate. In flat space, we get away with it. Because in flat space-time, we have an implicit rule that we can parallel transport all of our vectors as we integrate them. But that's an arbitrary rule that we don't have, you know, in curved space-time unless we say so, right? So this is not something that could be put under a volume integral, and therefore there's no way that this could be turned into a statement. Even using Gauss's theorem, there's no way that we could turn that into a statement that some global quantity defined as an integral over a space-like surface would be conserved. So even though we always say that this is a statement of energy momentum conservation, well, it's sort of true, but that doesn't mean that there's an actual conserved quantity that we can define associated with that. Here we can, because here we're actually integrating a scalar, and here it all works out. So when you have a divergence of a vector, you do have a conserved quantity. The divergence of a tensor really doesn't help you. And if you might have thought that, well, you can use this version of the integration theorem, well, it just wouldn't work because this requires an antisymmetric tensor field, whereas over here we have a symmetric tensor field. So there's just no way that we can express energy momentum conservation in GR as an integral statement of conservation. When we combine T mu nu with a Killing vector and we define something like this, where C is a Killing vector, this is a vector, and this is a vector that happens to have a zero divergence. And you can prove this based on this equation and the fact that when you differentiate the Killing vector, you get something antisymmetric that multiplies something symmetric, and therefore the divergence of this vector is zero. And when you have a Killing vector, then you can turn that into a global statement of conservation. But you need a Killing vector to do that. Yep. Sure. Right. So the whole point of talking about pseudo tensors is to say we're going to turn this equation into that equation. So we're going to replace all covariant derivatives by partial derivatives, and we're going to make up for that by introducing some additional quantity. And now we're going to formulate our integral statements pretending that we're working in flat space-time, just doing a straightforward integration based on the straightforward Gauss theorem based on partial derivatives. And that's useful sometimes. It's very dangerous because it's very tempting to associate way too much, physical meaning to this quantity. But if you do Poissonian theory, for example, this is a very, very useful thing to do. It has no particular physical meaning, but in terms of generating useful mathematical identities for your variables and your potentials, it turns out to be very powerful. So you have to worry a little bit about, not reading too much into that. But in terms of, mathematical usefulness, it's really good. Okay, so I apologize for going long. I think we've done enough today. So no class next week. We get the winter break, and we'll come back after that.